Okay, you're being handed out right now a couple of handouts. During our first session last week, we examined the first four councils of the ancient church, ecumenical councils. There are various councils that occur of the church. Sometimes you'll have a meeting of the four bishops of Wisconsin, and they'll just have a gathering of their own. Sometimes you'll have a meeting of a regional group. All of the Western bishops in the United States might get together. Sometimes all the U.S. bishops, the USCC, United States Catholic Conference, gets together at regular intervals. An ecumenical council, though, is a worldwide council. And we covered four of those last time. The first four being Nicaea in 325, which covered Arianism. Arianism, you'll recall, was the heresy that said Jesus was super angel. Remember that? What we have in our chart here is all of the ecumenical councils, all of the ones that have ever occurred throughout church history. So to finish reviewing the first four, after Nicaea, there was Constantinople. I mentioned a regional council there at Alexandria, but we won't mess with that. The second was Constantinople. In 381, they dealt with Apollinarianism, which said the Son replaces Jesus' human intellect and will. That was the glove heresy, if you remember that. The third was at Ephesus, 431. That dealt with Nestorianism. Nestorius had the schizophrenic Jesus. And fourthly, Council of Chalcedon in 451, which dealt with an early form of monophysitism called Eutychianism. Christ is one nature after the moment of conception when the two natures touch. It was at that council that the Orthodox Church, having condemned monophysitism, said that the Logos is the basis of the two natures union. Jesus has two natures. He's 100% human being, has human nature just like I do, and he's 100% God. So everything that God has, he has, but everything that a human being has, he also has. Sensations, emotions, thoughts. But the basis of the union, what causes him to be a single entity without admixture of the natures, but also without separation, is the divine nature. Well, that makes sense if you stop and think about it. Can a human nature cause itself to unite with God? No. But God could cause himself to unite with human nature. The term for this is hypostatic union. If you've ever heard that phrase. What that phrase means is what's said here under Chalcedon. The Logos is the basis of the two natures union. Now we're moving into new territory here with the fifth ecumenical council. This one also occurred at Constantinople. That's why we call the first one Constantinople I and this one Constantinople II. They dealt again with monophysitism and they dealt with Origenism. Origen, although mostly an Orthodox church father, had a kind of a strange theory that before the material universe was created, God created thousands of spiritual entities. Some of these spiritual entities, at the moment they were created, opted in favor of God. Some of these spiritual entities opted against God, and some of them stayed neutral. The ones that opted for God became the angels, the ones that opted against God became the demons, and the ones who couldn't make up their minds became us. So God created the universe as a place to house these ones who couldn't make up their minds, and that's how we wound up here. That's what I mean by pre-existent souls fell. That was a theory that the church condemned. We don't believe that, obviously. Good, yeah. The next ecumenical council, number 6, is in 680, again in Constantinople. They dealt with monothelitism. We did talk about that last time, actually, didn't we? One will-ism. Then there's Nicaea 2, the second council to be held in Nicaea in 787, and that dealt with iconoclasm. I'm going to talk about iconoclasm a bit later tonight, so I'm not going to talk about it now. So the first seven councils we think of as the ancient councils, because there's quite a gap. And then you get the medieval councils. Constantinople 4 ends a schism with the Eastern Church. The Ninth Council at Lateran 1, 1123, was a reforming council. Simony is referred to there. Simony means selling spiritual things. So instead of the best man becoming bishop, it was whoever could bribe the local lord of the manor would become bishop. That was condemned. There were efforts to impose celibacy better and so on. In 1139, there had been two people elected pope, two rival factions among the cardinals, each elected their own guy. So that was solved at this council. Lateran III dealt with a couple of heresies, which we'll probably mention next time, the Albigensians and the Waldensians. The 12th is the Fourth Lateran Council. It planned a crusade. It said that you could take communion, that you had to take communion at least once a year, and that's annual communion. It authorized the Franciscans, and it tried to make reforms. The 13th was the first at Lyon in France. Another crusade was planned. Frederick II was deposed. The 14th was the second at Lyon. Another attempt to reunite with the Greeks. Filioque is reaffirmed. I'll talk about that later tonight. Another attempt at reforms. A lot of attempts at reforms here, aren't there? Why are there so many attempts at reform? Because the church was in really bad shape. Why was the church in really bad shape in the Middle Ages? Say it again. Church and state was part of the problem. That's true. That's a good point. A lot of the problem stemmed from that period in between ancient times and modern times that we refer to as the Dark Ages. I've looked up these terms in several encyclopedias, and it seems to me that the consensus is those who use the term, a lot of people don't like the term nowadays, those who use the term consider it to be from approximately 500 to approximately 1,000. And those who use Middle Ages, that's 1,000 to 1,500 or so. And then you got the modern period. The Dark Ages, around 500, were brought on by my ancestors. My ancestors were the Germans. And the Germans were a bunch of guys up north of the Roman Empire, all tribal. They loved to have fights with one another. They loved to get drunk. They all rode their motorcycles down into the Roman Empire and tore the thing to shreds. They destroyed the Roman Empire. Gradually, they're absorbed and they become Catholic themselves. But they destroyed the Roman Empire. And throughout those 500 years, from roughly 500 to roughly 1,000, the light of learning was kept lit in the monasteries. But a lot of the ancient learning was lost, destroyed. Nobody had any copies of Aristotle anymore, for example. So the church emerges from the Dark Ages around 1,000, and commerce starts to pick up, and you're starting to get sizable cities again and so on. But when it emerges, the church is pretty bedraggled. You know, most of the priests aren't really celibate, and people are buying and selling religious offices and so on. So it was a difficult effort. The church was trying to pull itself up by the bootstraps throughout the Middle Ages. And that's why when we look at these medieval councils over and over again, they say, we're attempting reform, we're attempting reform, we're attempting reform. Okay, I believe we're up to Vienne, the 15th, in the 1300s, dealt with a couple of renegade groups, the Beguines and the Bagards. It abolished the Knights Templar, attempted reforms. The 16th was at Constance in the early 1400s, condemned Wycliffe and executed Hus. We're going to talk about those two guys next time. It ended the Great Schism. This time there were three popes, not just two, who had been elected simultaneously. The 17th was the Council of Florence in later in the 1400s. It again reunited the Greek church, made a settlement with the followers of Hus, and attempted reforms. The 18th was early 1500s. Da Vinci was alive at that time, creating his code. And Michelangelo was alive at that time. So what happened in Lateran V? Well, they dealt with the nature of the soul, and of course they tried to reform the church. We've only got three left, and those we consider to be the modern ecumenical councils, because we divide the Middle Ages from the modern period, roughly 1500, because that's roughly when Protestantism has occurred and the Renaissance was occurring, so it makes kind of a natural division there. Trent was the Catholic Church's response to Protestantism. We'll be looking at Trent later, two or three sessions from now. Excuse me, Vatican I was about 150 years ago, defined papal infallibility, and lastly, Vatican II, which is within the lifetime of some of us, not all of us. So there's a list of the worldwide councils. Worldwide because all the bishops in the world came together to make decisions about the life of the church and about doctrine. How many are there? What's the number of that last one? 21. How many centuries has the church been around? 20 centuries, 21 councils. So roughly one every 100 years is what we've averaged. Who knows when the next will be? Maybe it'll be Vatican III. If you look at the second page that you've been given, I zero in on that last one because that's the one that's of most relevance to us. How many bishops met at Vatican II? Just shy of 2,400. I think it was 2,393. As opposed to the first council, there were 220 bishops in existence all over the world. Of course, they were all right there in the Mediterranean basin. So the church has spread in the last 2,000 years all over the world, and consequently we have many, many more bishops. It was not primarily dogmatic, making decisions about doctrine, nor was it reforming, but it was pastoral. In fact, it's the first and only pastoral council that the church has ever had. What does it mean to say that it was a pastoral council? That means it was mostly concerned with how to be more effective in the world, how to make the church better understood, how to communicate better. It sought to enhance effective teaching, reaching out to the world. Based on renewals in biblical and liturgical studies, it produced 16 documents. The most important theologically are Dogmatic Constitution on the Church, Dogmatic Constitution on Divine Revelation, and the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World. These 16 documents are of three sorts, and I list them here for you. There's four constitutions. Both tend to be longer and more heavyweight. You've got Lumen Gentium, Dei Verbum, the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, and Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World. There's three declarations. Those are medium weight. Declaration on Christian Education, Declaration on the Relationship of the Church to Non-Christian Religions. I'll be talking about that quite a bit tomorrow night. And Declaration on Religious Freedom. There's a magnificent sentence in this Declaration on Religious Freedom, which I happened to be rereading a couple of days ago, and I came across this sentence. Let me share it with you. I liked it so much, I made myself memorize it. I'm going to be very embarrassed if I can't remember it now. Truth cannot impose itself except by virtue of its own truth, as it makes its entrance into the mind quietly and with power. You like that sentence? Truth cannot impose itself except by virtue of its own truth. You can't force somebody to believe something. In other words, no more crusades, no more inquisitions. From now on, the only tool we will use is persuasion. The truth itself is sufficient to persuade people eventually. I like that. Anyway, we're off the subject. There's 9 decrees. These are of least size and tend to be of lighter matters. Although I must say that the decree on ecumenism is a pretty important document. You've got decrees on the pastoral office of bishops, on priestly training, ministry and life of priests, adaptation and renewal of religious life, the apostolate of the laity, Catholic churches of the Eastern Rite, ecumenism, mission activity of the church, and media of social communication. As you look through those, you can see that the thrust of this last, most recent council was pastoral. How can the church shepherd humanity? Anyway, I thought you might like to see, since we've talked about the first 4, what are the other ecumenical councils? These ecumenical councils are also useful to us in our topic for this series, because we're talking about what the neighbors think. You know, what do other Christians besides Catholics think? And we can use the ecumenical councils as kind of a rough rule of thumb about the 3 major divisions of Christianity. The 3 major divisions of Christianity are the Roman Catholic, the Eastern Orthodox, and the Protestants. Roman Catholics accept all 21 of these councils. How about Eastern Orthodox? Well, they split off right there after the 7th one, pretty much, and didn't participate in numbers 9 through 21, or 8 through 21, so they accept the first 7 councils. Everything that was decided there, they agree with. Everything decided after that, they're not bound to. How about Protestants? The first 4. They accept the first 4, and not the ones afterward. Now, yes, sir. Because the first 4 dealt with incarnation, which is what we looked at last time. All those heresies we looked at were having to do with the incarnation, the relationship between the two natures of Christ. The first 4 dealt with incarnation and with Trinity. And the Protestants had no problem with those. Now, here's an interesting... This is relevant to your question, I think. Look at number 7. Number 7 was 787, second one at Nicaea. It dealt with something here called iconoclasm. Iconoclasm comes from a couple of Greek words. Icon plus plasmos. Icon, what's that sound like? Icon, exactly. That's where our word icon comes from. It's the Greek word for image. And plasmos is the Greek word for to break, as in cataclysm. Kata means down, so downward breaking. So put these two together, and you've got breakers of images. The iconoclasts were Christians, mostly in the eastern half of the Roman Empire, who came up with the idea that because God is pure spirit, you ought to worship him solely in a spiritual way. And you should not use any sensory aids to your worship. This idea was adopted by the Roman emperor in the eastern half of the empire. And so he sent out his soldiers to the churches. And they would go into a church and pull down the statues and smash them and tear up the... pictures on the walls and all the rest of it. You are not to use any sensory aids because God is spirit and therefore his worship must be spirit. So they literally were icon breakers. What happened? Well, the church said we need a council. So they all got together at Nicaea, 787, discussed the issue and decided, baloney. There's nothing wrong with using sensory aids in worshiping. God, after all, where did your senses come from? God created them, right? God created your senses. God doesn't make junk. There's nothing wrong with their senses. Let's go ahead and use them to worship God. So, as a result, we got a crucifix hanging here. We got a nice big picture right up here. Too bad it's night. We could look at the glorious stained glass windows. Here's the... those are iconic. We use lots of sensory aids in Catholicism. We got miraculous medals and scapulars and holy cards and rosary. We got all kinds of sensory aids. But do Protestants accept the Seventh Council? No, they don't. If you go into a Protestant church, are you going to find a crucifix? You'll find a cross. Crucifix has the corpus, the body on it. You might have stained glass windows, but chances are they'll be abstract rather than saints or representational. No Stations of the Cross, etc. So they didn't accept this decision. Yeah. Yeah. I don't, she said she'd heard that Protestants don't have crucifixes but crosses because Christ has already risen and therefore you shouldn't represent him being crucified. I've heard that theory myself. I don't know if that's later apologetics, you know, coming up with an explanation after the fact in order to explain it better. Or maybe it's true. I don't know. But you would agree that, generally speaking, there's a heck of a more sensory aids to worship in Catholicism than there is in... How about Eastern Orthodoxy? Do they use sensory aids? Oh, yeah, sure. In fact, icons are... What's an icon? A picture. What's it on? What's it painted on? Wood. You take a block of wood, usually rectangular, vertical, and you paint... What do you paint on it in Eastern Orthodoxy? Of saints. A given saint, yeah. Or Mary. Lots of Mary. Some of those icons of Mary from the Byzantine period are very beautiful and used in Catholic churches as well. Yeah. Is that right? Well, I never heard that before. She said she was in Greece this summer, went to a lot of churches, was told and saw lots of icons, but she was told that they can't have statues. That's news to me. Huh. I wonder when that decision was made. Yeah, and I wonder if that's Greece only or if that's throughout those churches. Yeah. Erin was saying that she learned in her class at UST on Western religions that Greek Orthodox churches aren't, or Eastern Orthodox churches can only have two-dimensional images, not three-dimensional. First I heard that. I'll be talking to Sister Grace tomorrow. You can... Yeah, good. Ah, she was raised in a church that centuries ago had been Eastern Orthodox and then rejoined with Rome. And she said that they did have statues, but they're in the vestibule. When you go into the church sanctuary, it's all paintings on the walls. Is that correct? Another thing we talked about at the end of the period last time was the Nestorians and the Monophysites. The Nestorians were the followers of Nestorius in 431 when the Council of Ephesus decided against Nestorius and said it's not two natures that remain two individual entities, it's two natures that form a single entity. These followers of Nestorius broke off and became a church of their own. Well, I looked it up, and here's the scoop on the Nestorians. The Nestorians came to America, founded a church first in America in 1907. They are known as the Holy Apostolic and Catholic Church of the East. And in 1940, their patriarch moved his headquarters from Iraq to San Francisco. Where's that woman that thought I was making that up? So it is true, they are actually headquartered in San Francisco now. In America, there's about 35,000 of them. Not many left. The Monophysites were the ones who broke away 20 years later in 451 when the church decided that the two natures do not become a single nature, the divine absorbing the human, but rather remain distinct, although inseparable. The Monophysites, one naturists, disagreed, broke away, and so you wind up with the Arminian Orthodox, came to America in 1889, the Syrian Orthodox, also known as Jacobites, they came to America in 1895, they currently have their patriarch of Antioch in Damascus, the Ethiopian Orthodox, came to America in 1959, and the Coptic Orthodox, who came to America in 1960. When I say came to America, I don't mean the majority of them, as happened with the Nestorians, but rather immigrants from these churches set up their own churches here in America. Okay, so much for branches of Christianity that came into existence in the ancient world and are still with us. What we next want to cover is the next major group to have split, and that, of course, is the Eastern Orthodox. There were reasons, even in ancient times, why the eastern half of the Roman Empire tended to diverge from the western half. For one thing, the eastern half spoke Greek. The western half, however, spoke Latin. So right there, you're going to have trouble communicating. Other differences crept in. The eastern half of the Christians celebrated Easter on the same day every year. We know from the gospel accounts that the Last Supper was apparently a Passover meal. It has the appearance of one, like a Seder supper. So if you calculate back to 30 AD, which is the probable date of Jesus' death and resurrection, Passover was on the 14th day of the month Nisan. Nisan is a name of a month that the Jews had. So the eastern half, the Christians in the eastern half of the Roman Empire always celebrated Easter on the 14th of Nisan. Well, that means that it's going to be on a different day of the week every year. One year it'll be on Sunday, the next year it might be on Wednesday, the next year it'll be on Thursday, because the date skips around, right? Western half of the empire, however, developed the custom of having Easter on the first Sunday after the first new moon, after the spring equinox. And that's how we determine Easter now. First Sunday after the first full moon, that's the spring equinox. Yes? My guess is that it would have arisen because that way it's always on a Sunday. And that's the day he rose. Well, this caused problems between the eastern half Christians and the western half Christians. So when the Patriarch of Constantinople, who was head honcho in the eastern area, came to visit the Pope in 195 AD, the Pope had it out with him and said, "You guys need to get in line and celebrate Easter the same time we do." Well, I'm sure he was disgruntled and resentful, but the Patriarch said, okay. And therefore, the Eastern Christians gave up doing it on a different day of the week every year and instead followed the same custom as we, and therefore Christians around the world all have the same Easter day every year. Another detail in which the Easterners differed from the Westerners was the bread that was used at Mass. The Easterners used bread with yeast in it. The Westerners, on the other hand, used bread without yeast, called unleavened bread. Leaven is another word for yeast. Why would the Westerners have used unleavened bread? Exactly. At the Last Supper, if it was a Passover meal, we know the Jews had to use unleavened bread. So we're continuing on with what Jesus actually lifted. Why they used yeast in the East, I don't know. But that became their custom, and so this was a controversy, and that was not resolved. It's still the case that Eastern Orthodox use leavened bread. Add to these differences that were starting to creep in the fact that the Roman Empire was becoming politically separate. Shortly after 300 AD, the emperor, whose name was Diocletian, decided that the empire was just too huge to be governed all from one center, which was Rome. And Rome tended to be toward the western border of the empire. So Diocletian decided that he would reorganize the empire and he would have a second capital over toward the eastern border. This capital that he decided upon was the city of Byzantium. Byzantium was an ancient, noble, beautiful city. He opted for that as the place where the new Rome, the capital of the eastern half of the Roman Empire, would be. Consequently, there were now two Caesars. There was a Caesar in Rome, and there was a Caesar in Byzantium. Not only that, but each of them had a vice Caesar, a Caesar in waiting who would take over when the Caesar died. Well, this was a dumb idea, because put four politically aggressive guys together, and what are you going to get? Wars and chaos, and that's exactly what happened. Out of these wars and chaos, one emperor emerged, and that was Constantine. Constantine defeated the Eastern, having replaced Diocletian, defeated the Eastern emperor, reunited the two halves, and renamed Byzantium after himself. Henceforward, it was to be called Constantinople. Later on, when the Muslims took it over, it's on the northern edge of present-day Turkey, they renamed it again and they called it Istanbul, right, which is its name currently. Well, even though Constantine reunited the empire, that division that Diocletian had made had a real basis in fact, because the two halves of the empire were becoming more culturally and ethnically diverse. It's kind of like cell division. You've all seen this on educational TV. You got a sphere, and then gradually it moves apart. Pretty soon you got a dumbbell with a little... And then, because that's exactly what happened. The two halves of the Roman Empire just got further and further apart. And as they did, the two halves of Christianity got further and further apart. Now, this all came to a crisis in the 800s AD. In the 800s AD, you had the iconoclasts. And that was settled, theoretically, at the Council of Nicaea II in 787. Afterward, the iconoclastic clergy, the priests who had gone along with the emperor and had said, yeah, smash those statues and so on, wanted back in. They wanted to be accepted back. The Patriarch of Constantinople, a fellow named Ignatius, said, no way. You guys are traitors to the church. I'm not going to let you back in. Well, they had their own champion, who was a fellow named Photius, and Photius persuaded the bishops in the East, some majority of them anyway, to elect him Patriarch of Constantinople and depose Ignatius. So what did Ignatius do? He turned to Rome and he said, Daddy, that's not fair. Papa? Papa is Italian for Pope. This is not fair. They kicked me out. The Pope looked at the situation and said, he's right. That was illegal. Ignatius is still the Patriarch of Constantinople. Well, that really endeared him to Photius, didn't it? Not at all. So Photius, in anger, refuses to acknowledge this order from the Pope to give up his office and give it back to Ignatius. Another problem that occurred at about the same time, we're now about the mid-800s, another problem that occurred was the conversion of the Slavs. The Slavs are those peoples that currently occupy Romania, Bulgaria, what else? Czechoslovakia. Although it's not called that anymore, is it? The Czech Republic and Slovakia, Slovenia. Yeah, and Herzegovina and Poland, all that, exactly, Macedonia, all that central area there, those are the Slavs, and of course the Russians are Slavs also. The Patriarch of Constantinople sent out a couple of excellent missionaries, Cyril and Methodius, in the first half of the 800s, and they converted all these peoples. And right in the middle of the 800s, they converted the Bulgarians, whose king was Boris. So when Boris converted to Christianity, all of his people also had to give up paganism and become Christians, all on the same day, thousands of people. So Photius was delighted. He's now got these thousands more, tens of thousands more followers. But a year later, when it was time to establish a hierarchy and an organization of bishops and priests, what did Boris, king of the Bulgarians, do but contact Rome and ask the Pope to send bishops and priests? Well, this ticked off Photius, of course. Here was just one more instance where that busybody Pope from the West is trying to meddle in our affairs. Photius, outraged, called a council. Not a world council, but a council of the Eastern bishops. And at this council at Constantinople, he excommunicated the Pope. And he deposed him. You're no longer bishop of Rome. Of course, the Pope completely ignored this. A few years later, Ignatius, the guy who had been Patriarch of Constantinople that Photius kicked out, died. So there's only one Patriarch of Constantinople left, and therefore, in order to heal the schism, the Pope agreed that Photius was the Patriarch of Constantinople. So this first schism of about 10 years gets healed. But this is not the end of the story. Another controversy erupts soon afterward. And to discuss this controversy, we have to go back a little bit. The second ecumenical council, if you check your chart, the second one is the first one at Constantinople. It occurs in 381. I mentioned to you last time that although Nicaea created the Nicene Creed, Constantinople in 381 revised it. Remember that? So that actually it's the Niceo-Constantinopolitan Creed. This creed said, the Spirit proceeds from the Father. What do we say when we say the creed? The Holy Spirit, who proceeds from the Father and the Son. But that wasn't originally part of the Niceo-Constantinopolitan Creed. We added, we Westerners, later on, added to the creed the Latin word filioque, which means and the Son. This word started to be added in the 500s, about 150 years after the creed itself. It started being added in various parishes and dioceses in Spain. From there, it spread on throughout the West, and the Pope gave it its blessing. That's why it's still part of our creed today. The East, however, never accepted it. So now that there's this hard feelings between the Patriarch of Constantinople, Photius, and the Pope in Rome, Photius dredges this up and says, you guys are heretics because you've messed with the creed. This cannot be allowed. He tried to resurrect the schism, started up again, but he died. So hard feelings were left on both sides, but it was kind of an uneasy truce from this point on. This truce lasts for about 200 years, a bit less than 200 years. Tensions between East and West erupt again right around the mid-1000s, about 1050 or so. This time, the Patriarch of Constantinople is a fellow named Michael Cerularius. Let me read you what happened at this time. Around 1050, the papacy decided to rid southern Italy of all traces of Eastern influence and to impose the Latin Rite on the churches there. So apparently, southern Italy at this time was using yeast in their bread and all that kind of stuff. They were using the Eastern customs. The Pope doesn't want that right on his doorstep, the southern part of Italy. He decides it's going to become Latin. To achieve this, get rid of Eastern influence in southern Italy, the Pope made an alliance with the Normans, who were originally Vikings. Norman means Northmen, and had now settled in France. He made an alliance with the Normans, who promptly provided the necessary military force to impose Latin customs on the churches in southern France. Hardly had this been achieved when the papacy became nervous about the growing strength of their new allies, and so the Pope appealed to the East for help against the Normans. The Patriarch of Constantinople, Michael Cerularius, led the refusal to become involved in such power politics, and he added fuel to the controversy by imposing the Eastern Rite on Latin churches in Constantinople. He also condemned several Western practices. He condemned unleavened bread, he condemned celibate priesthood, and he condemned filioque, this addition. The Pope has his hands full dealing with the Normans. He sends one of his cardinals, a fellow named Cardinal Humbert, originally from Spain, he sends Cardinal Humbert over to Constantinople to try and patch things up. He sent the wrong guy. Cardinal Humbert was kind of an irascible, no-nonsense curmudgeon. So when Humbert arrived in Constantinople, he didn't even bother to go meet with the Patriarch of Constantinople, Michael Cerularius. Instead, he went to the Basilica Church of the Cathedral Church and laid a writ of excommunication on the altar and left. This writ said, Michael, Patriarch of Constantinople, is sowing an abundant crop of heresies, including those of the Simoniacs, Valesians, Arians, Donatists, Nicolaitans, Cerverians, Pneumaticoi, and Nazarenes. I have no idea who those are either. Basically, he said, you're totally evil. He finished his writ of excommunication by saying, let Michael and all those who follow him in the above-mentioned errors come under the anathema. Anathema means curse. Let everyone who persists in attacking the faith of the Holy Roman Church and its sacrifice be anathema. Come, Lord Jesus, and not be considered as a Catholic Christian, but as a prosimitic heretic. Sorry about that. Zimos is Greek for yeast. So prosimitic means in favor of yeast. That's how he ended the document. You're nothing but a pro-yeast heretic. Well, Michael, of course, discovers this writ of excommunication on his altar. What does he do? He writes an encyclical, a circular letter to the Eastern half of the Roman Empire, those bishops, in which he upheld the orthodoxy of the East, he condemned the heresy of the West, he maintained in the letter that reconciliation with Rome is not even desirable. Consequently, the permanent schism between Eastern Orthodox churches and Catholicism dates from that time. And that was the year 1054. There have been some efforts since then to heal the schism. One of the ecumenical councils that's listed for you was Lyon, 1270s. At the Council of Lyon, does it say there that they tried to Greeks reunited? It didn't last. Another council, this one at Florence, which occurred in the 1430s and 40s, also reunited the Greeks. But when we say reunited the Greeks, we're not talking about the masses, we're talking about the leadership. Here's an ecumenical council taking place in Lyon, or taking place a couple hundred years later in Florence, and the leadership, the Patriarch of Constantinople and his head honchos, hop over and attend the council. There's a document written up for the Easterners which says, if you sign this and agree to it, then our schism is healed. And they signed it, and they agreed to it. But when they got back over to the East and showed it to the people in the pews, the people said, no way. So there actually have been these two instances of reuniting of Eastern Christianity with Western, but it lasted less than a year each time because the people as a whole would not go along with it. I don't see a clock in here. You must get awfully long homilies. 8 o'clock? So I got a half hour, approximately. Okay, good. What I want to do now is talk about the differences between Eastern Orthodox Christianity and Western. How do we differ nowadays? Enough history, let's talk about now. But first I'll take this question. Go ahead, sir. Oh, okay, good. So Jeff, if you would. Thank you. No, we don't. That's one of the problems. Well, I failed to grab a copy for myself. If I can grab one of these. May I? That's my fault. Thank you. Okay, what we've got here is a handout entitled Major Differences Between Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. I refer to Eastern Orthodoxy rather than Greek Orthodoxy because there's other branches besides Greek. What other branches of Eastern Orthodoxy do you know of? Russian is probably the biggest, actually, in the world. Anything else? Ukrainian Orthodox, very good. Belarus, you've been hearing about that in the news? You know, the dictator faked the election. Belarusians are Orthodox, there's Belarusian Orthodox. Hey, what about the Serbs? Slobodan Milosevic just died, that dictator of the Serbs. Serbian Orthodox, Bulgarian Orthodox, that's right. All the ones that Cyril and Methodius back in the 800s converted to Orthodoxy. Yeah, that's right. So there's lots of branches, hence my use of the term Eastern rather than specify any one or a set. But all of them are very similar in their practices because they all flow out of that Constantinople leadership in the early church. All right. On the left, I've got various topics, and in the middle, I've got what Catholicism says about it, and in the right, I've got Eastern Orthodoxy. Ecumenical councils accepted. Catholicism accepts all 21. Eastern Orthodoxy accepts the first 7. Influential local councils. Council of Orange, we accept, where we argued against semi-Pelagianism. Semi-Pelagianism was a heresy which said, God will give you graces, and lots of them, but only after you, by your own free will, turn toward Him. And the church said, no. Catholicism says that's not the case. God sends you graces before you turn, and those graces help you to turn. Toledo, in 589 in Spain, affirmed the filioque officially for the first time. In the East, there was a Council of Constantinople in 1341 and 1351. Hesychasm is a certain spiritual practice. There's one in Jassy in 1642 concerning the Eucharist and ecclesiology. I don't know what was decided there. And in Jerusalem in 1672, where they affirmed their canon. I suspect that they affirmed their canon in 1642 because we Catholics, a century earlier at Trent, affirmed our canon. Canon is a list or set of sacred books. Here's a timeline from 1000 BC down to roughly the present. Starting in the 900s BC, the earliest parts of the Old Testament start to be written down. Probably those early parts of Genesis, all that stuff. As the centuries go by, other works that are now in the Old Testament get written. Isaiah was written about 701. Job was written around 450. Song of Songs probably written in the 300s, etc. By the time you get to 200 BC, a lot of Jews have forgotten how to read and write Hebrew because after Alexander the Great conquered everything, everybody was speaking Greek. So the scriptures got translated from Hebrew into Greek. This translation is known as the Septuagint because supposedly there were 70 translators. Septuagint in Latin means 70. This translation of the Hebrew books of the Old Testament, what you and I call the Old Testament, Jews call it the Bible, was translated around 200 into Greek, and it wound up with about 46 books, maybe 46, maybe 48. Nobody had a Bible all inside two covers because back then they used scrolls. So if you went to a bookstore in Jerusalem, you could take the Genesis scroll and the Exodus scroll and so on and kind of make up your own Bible. So the edges of the canon, the set or list of sacred books, was a bit fluid. Well, after the ADBC line, Jesus comes, Christianity is established. The early Christians could either use the Hebrew versions of the documents, or they could use the Greek versions of the documents. What language is the New Testament written in? Greek. All 27 books in the New Testament are all written in Greek. Now, if you're Paul, and let's say you sit down one night to write the letter to the Romans, and you're writing along and you come to a spot where you want to quote from the Old Testament, you can pull down your Hebrew scroll of Genesis and look up a passage and translate it, or you can pull down your Greek copy of Genesis, look it up, and copy it. Which is easier? Copy it. If you examine the 200 allusions and quotations of the Old Testament in Paul's letters, 75% of them are from the Septuagint. He obviously used the Septuagint, primarily, as his scriptures. This is true not only for him. If you look at the Old Testament usage in Matthew, it's the same thing. So the early Christians are using the Septuagint, and therefore they're using around 46 or 48 books. The Jews get upset that the Christians are running around proving that Jesus is the Messiah using these writings that the Jews themselves wrote. So the Jews have a meeting. All the rabbis get together. It's called the Council of Jamnia. That's the town they met in. They meet about 100 A.D., about 300 years after the Septuagint came into use. And they decide that we Jews must make a decision as to what's in and what's out. They talk about it for a while. What they wind up with is 39 books in their Bible, what you and I call the Old Testament. This did not, of course, cause the Christians to give up their canon, which was 7 or 9 or 8 books bigger. So from this point on, throughout the Middle Ages, the Jews are using 39 books, and the Christians, all Christians, are using 46 to 48 books. That remains the case for over 1,000 years until the Reformation. Traditional date for the Protestant Reformation is 1517, so I'll put that there. Luther decided to translate the Bible from Hebrew Old Testament and Greek New Testament into German for his followers, the Lutherans, who were just starting up. He had to decide whether to use the Christian canon or the Jewish canon. Well, he said to himself, who wrote the Old Testament anyway? The Jews did. If anybody knows what ought to be in the Old Testament, it ought to be the Jews. Therefore, he opted to go with the Jewish canon. And he eliminated from the Catholic canon, as it had existed for 1,500 years, he eliminated 7 books and wound up with 39. Those 7 books, in case you're curious, are Tobit, Judith, 1 Maccabees, 2 Maccabees, Book of Wisdom, Sirach, and Baruch. From that time forward, Luther's Bible came out in 1536, from that time forward, Protestants have had the same Old Testament as the Jews, 39 books, and therefore they lack those 7 books that had been part of Christian canon until the Reformation. Trent was the response to Protestantism, that ecumenical council. Luther's Bible came out in 1536. Trent started in 1545, and one of the first things they did was to say, we don't agree with you on the canon. And here's our books. And they listed 46 books in the Old Testament, and then they listed the 27 in the New. Well, 46 is how many books you and I have in our Old Testament. I don't know why, and I've never come across an explanation. My guess is nobody knows. For some reason, in the eastern half of the Roman Empire, back when nobody can really trace it, it became customary in the eastern half of the empire to have 48 books in the Old Testament. We Catholics have 46 books. The Eastern Orthodox have 46. They've got those 7 plus 2 more. And the Protestants only have 39. They've got the Old Testament minus these. The 2 books that are in Eastern Orthodox Bibles that are not in Catholic Bibles are 3 Maccabees and 1 Esdras. Ever heard of 1 Esdras? Well, you're obviously not Eastern Orthodox, are you? Because if you were, you'd see that in your Bible. Okay, so back to our chart. This is one of the differences between us. We said, obviously for years we had by custom used 46 books for centuries, but we explicitly said, here's our canon in 1545, and then not too long afterward, the Eastern Orthodox respond and say, here's our canon, and there's 48 in the Old Testament. All right. Papacy. Well, obviously we differ here. According to us Catholics, the Pope is the universal supreme head of the church, has jurisdiction. In Eastern Orthodoxy, they're willing to call him the chief bishop. They're willing to say he's first in the ecumenical college, but he does not have universal jurisdiction. He's in charge of his diocese. And we all look up to him, and we all give him a kind of an honorary primacy, but he's not in charge. Laity rarely preach or perform as spiritual directors in our church. Isn't that true? But they often do in Eastern churches. In Russia, there's a lot of famous spiritual directors throughout history. Rasputin, for example. Sacraments. We have seven sacraments, and they're carefully distinguished. The Easterners don't call them sacraments. They usually call them mysterioi, mysteries. They're not as carefully distinct from rites other than those seven, such as monastic profession, blessing the waters at Epiphany, performing a burial, anointing a monarch. These are holy rites also, and maybe the seven are a bit holier, but there's not that big distinction we have. These are the seven. Everything else is just a rite. Baptism. According to us, it can be any running water. According to Easterners, it has to be by immersion. You go totally under. When I was doing my master's degree in theology, I had a fellow student who was preparing for the priesthood, but at that time a layman like myself. One time, he was driving out in the country, and he topped a hill, and there at the bottom of the hill, a car had gone off the road and had hit a tree. So my friend slowed down, pulled over, got out, rushed over, and saw that the guy was in terrible shape and probably wasn't going to make it. So the first thing my friend did was to call 911. The second thing my friend did was to spit on his forehead. Why do you do that? What? To baptize him. Running water as it went down his forehead. And my friend said, I baptize you in the name of the Father and Son and the Holy Spirit. And if you don't want this, fine. You know, if you're Jewish or whatever, but in case you want it, here it is. Baptism, unlike most of the sacraments, can be performed by any Catholic, by a layperson. It doesn't have to be a priest. For us, I don't know about the Easterners. That's a good question. Confirmation. When were you confirmed? What age? When? Teens? Teens? 10? Confirmation? Wow. My kids, who got confirmed 15 years ago, I suppose, were mid-teens. Isn't that typical now, you think? Okay, good. So, around puberty, it says. I think it's a little later now. But check out the Easterners. As soon as you take your baby to be baptized, a week after birth or so, they baptize the baby, and then they break off a little tiny piece of a host and put it in the baby's mouth. That's First Communion, 8 days old. And then they do confirmation, which a local priest is able to do in the Eastern Rite, not the bishop. So bam, 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 you get all three right there on the same day. Whereas for us, baptism as an infant, First Communion around 7, and confirmation in the teens. That's the next one, isn't it? First Communion. Theory of the Eucharist. Our theory of the Eucharist is transubstantiation. Here's the word, transubstantiation. You'll notice that the root of it is substance. Substance means to stand under. So if you have bread, here's a wafer. According to Catholicism, there's a substance name that stands under this object. It's the essence of it, or the nature of it. that which stands under it and causes it to be what it is. And that is the nature of bread. But at the moment of consecration, when the priest lifts it and says, "This is my body," the nature of bread goes away, and another nature, namely the nature of Jesus, comes in, and that is the nature that now stands under. You can see why we call it transubstantiation, because we're transferring in this new nature. So for us, after the moment of consecration, this absolutely literally is Jesus. Now, Eastern Orthodox agree with that theory. They also say the bread is no longer bread. It is now the body of Christ. But they don't like the term transubstantiation. I don't know why. It makes a lot of sense to me. But for some reason, they tend not to call it that. True, good point. He said that at the Fourth Lateran Council, they made that term official, and that's after the split. That's a good point. Thank you. Frequency of communion. Every Sunday for us, sometimes daily if you want. Pius X, back in between 1900 and 1910, urged people to take it daily. In the East, however, it's 4 to 5 times a year, after careful preparation and confession. Celibacy. Yes. I have no idea. But why do you assume they must have been doing it weekly? It does seem reasonable. Yeah. If you look at the book of Acts, they're meeting every Sunday. So, yeah. I don't know. That's an excellent question. That's your homework assignment for next week. You find that out and bring it to us. Celibacy. We have a celibate priesthood. Eastern Orthodox have a partially celibate clergy. Most priests are married, but bishops cannot be married. Bishops can never have been married. And if you're a priest and your wife dies, you have to stay celibate. So consequently, if most of the priests are married, the only ones who are ever going to be able to go on and be a bishop are the ones who haven't gotten married, which is going to be the monks. So most bishops in Eastern Orthodoxy wind up being people out of monasteries. Bishops. Oh, well, that's the next one, isn't it? Drawn from secular priests. You're probably familiar with the distinction between two types of priests, secular priests and religious priests. Secular priests don't care. Religious priests, no, that's not true. Secular priests means that they belong to a diocese and owe obedience to a bishop. Religious priests means that they belong to a religious order and owe obedience to their superior in the order. So in both cases, we draw our bishops from secular priests. Liturgical language. Ours was Latin until 1965. Some of you remember those days. But we've used the modern vernacular since. Easterners use a vernacular, usually in archaic form. So Arminians, well, not Arminians. Syrian Orthodox use Old Church Syrian, a later form of Aramaic. Icons, not very important for us. Anybody own an icon? Some of you do. What's your icon of? Oh, okay. Yeah. Given to him by a friend who is Greek Orthodox. Somebody else had a hand up. Yeah. Pankrator. Yeah. Christ's cosmic king. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Still, what is that, 5 hands or so? Not that important for us, but very, very important for Eastern Orthodox. Yes, sir. Yes, you can. Because at the time of the schism, their clergy was in apostolic succession from the apostles and has remained so. Consequently, you're allowed, as a Catholic, to take communion in an Orthodox church. I don't know. He asked if the reverse were true. I don't know about that. He's asking about the origin of celibacy in the West. And Lateran I is a medieval council, and celibacy is listed there, but that's not because it's its origin. That's because they were trying to reform the clergy and impose celibacy. So a lot of the... That's debated. There's several books out right now. Some say it goes all the way back to the apostles. Some say it doesn't. And so it's not determined. There are Catholic priests who are not celibate. So that would seem to suggest to me that it's an ecclesiastical tradition and not an apostolic tradition. It would seem to be something that we're free to change if we want. I had a fellow teacher at UST in the theology department who had been an Episcopal priest. And then he came to the conclusion that Catholicism was true rather than Anglicanism, and therefore converted, became a Catholic. He was in Boston at the time. He went to the Archbishop of the Boston Archdiocese and said, I want to be a priest in the Catholic Church. And the Archbishop ordained him. But he already had a wife and kids, and he had a wife and kids here in Houston, even though he's a Catholic priest. So, you now know most of what I know about celibacy. Okay, let's finish this off and then we'll call it a night. We've only got a couple left. Prayers to Mary and saints during the liturgy are rare for us. We don't normally do Litany of the Saints or any of those, whereas they're emphasized in Eastern Orthodoxy. Eastern Orthodox services can go on for 3 and 4 hours. If you flip the page over, you'll see the back. Immaculate Conception of Mary. We believe it. Eastern Orthodox don't. Immaculate Conception is not the same as virgin birth. Virgin birth refers to Jesus. Mary was a virgin before, during, and after. Immaculate Conception refers to Mary, her conception, the moment sperm and egg merged and she became a zygote, she was without original sin. A special privilege given to her by God, I assume, because she was going to have charge of Jesus and would be raising him. No. Immaculate Conception, immaculate means spotted. Immaculate means not spotted. So Mary, unlike all other human beings except Jesus' human nature, did not have the spot of original sin. That's what immaculate there means. Well, not having original sin doesn't mean you can't sin. Otherwise, Adam and Eve in the garden wouldn't have sinned. He's suggesting that if God caused this miracle of Mary being conceived without original sin, then it was predetermined that she would be the mother of Jesus, and that causes problems with determinism and free will. I'm not sure that's the case, though. God could have intended her to, and she still could have rejected it at age 14 or whatever she was. He said, God can give you a talent to play music, but if you choose not to, you still got the talent. She did not have what are called the preternatural gifts that are associated with Adam and Eve, which are immortality, infused knowledge, lack of concupiscence, etc. But so she would have died a natural death and all those other things. Just to finish off, we're out of time. Two more. Bodily Assumption of Mary. We both agree on. That was defined in 1854 for us. They call it the Dormition, which is falling asleep of Mary. And Purgatory, we both agree on, but this is somewhat contentious item because we tend to think of it as a place and they tend to think of it as ethereal, immaterial. As far as I know, their idea of confession is the same. There is one reference to it there under Eucharist, frequency of communion. It said they do it 4 to 5 times a year after careful preparation and confession. So I infer from that that they probably have confess once a quarter or so. That's an excellent question to end with. He asked, John Paul II was very interested in ecumenism, how much progress has been made in reuniting Catholicism and the Eastern Orthodox. At the end of Vatican Council II, which occurred from 1962 to 1965, Pope Paul VI held a ceremony at the Vatican, which was simultaneously held by the Patriarch of Constantinople in Istanbul. Paul VI in Rome and Patriarch Athenagoras in Istanbul. And both of them, this is 1965, both of them simultaneously lifted the excommunications. Remember Cardinal Humbert back in 1054 excommunicated the Patriarch, and then the Patriarch turned around and excommunicated the... So, we're no longer excommunicated. That's good news, huh? And they're no longer excommunicated. Only took 900 years. Hey, we're boogieing. Could I add one more comment to his? You asked how much progress is occurring. John Paul II traveled everywhere. We're all aware of that. When he went to Eastern Orthodox countries, he had to be protected. They do not like us. And a lot of that comes from the Crusades, because in one of the Crusades, a bunch of the Crusaders went through Constantinople, this is 1204, went through Constantinople on their way to Jerusalem to fight the Muslims, and they trashed the place. They raped the women. They stole everything. They set up a Latin kingdom, which lasted for 70 or so years. That has never been forgiven, because that was their principal city. So there's a lot of animosity to be gotten over before we're going to see reuniting, but I pray that it'll happen someday. Oh, I'm sorry, she had a question. Well, they and we both agree that there are gifts of the Holy Spirit that a person gets with confirmation. So, and they look at it as a confirmation of the faith that they receive with baptism. But they don't demand the free will decision, I guess, that we do. Yeah. Sure, at the beginning of each council, somebody stood up there and said, "Testing, Jeff, how's that?" No, we have excellent records on most of the councils. They're a bit spotty on some of those early ones. But I would say, after the first four, and we've got all the major decisions from the first four, but after the first four, we've got very good records. There's a fellow named Monsi who published all of the conciliar decisions of the Catholic Church, and it's multi-volumes. But that's not just ecumenical, that's all the locals and regional. There are none. He said he's got a stupid question. I said there are none. That's a good question. How long did it take to get to the councils? There's no telephones, yeah. The papacy sent messengers a couple years ahead of time. We're going to have a council in a couple of years. And they got there as best they could. Some rode in a cart with an ox pulling them. St. Thomas Aquinas was on his way to the Council of Lyon in early 1200, or 1274, I guess it was, and was thinking heavily and wasn't watching where he was going and whacked his head on a tree branch and died on the way to the council. So he was riding a horse or a donkey to get there. I guess that's what most people did. Don't know. One more question. Aaron, did you have one? Oh, I thought you had your hand up earlier. Okay. Thank you all. We'll see you all next time.